This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. As the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks approaches, we can expect a barrage of images, stories, sounds, and of course our own memories of that terrible day. Much of it will be familiar. There are the moments from that event we lived and relived a thousand times in the past decade. Some of us may not want to look back anymore. Others of us may be seeking a new way to connect with and understand 9/11. How do we go about memorializing an event that was so deeply personal for every American, but is also freighted with layers of politics, symbolism, and conflicting cultural memories? Joining me in the studio to tackle the question is Tom Rankin, director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Also with us, Tim Tyson, senior research scholar at the Center and visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School. Welcome back to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
I want to start by listening to something new from September 11th. This is just released tape, and few of us have heard this. Just today we learned of a newly published chronicle of the civil and military aviation responses to the hijacking on that day. This was originally prepared for the investigators of the 9/11 Commission, but hasn't been released. It's a short excerpt, and this is air traffic controllers in New York as the second plane descends toward the World Trade Center.
Hey, can you look out your window right now?
Yes.
Can you see a guy at about 4,000 feet, about 5 East Airport right now? Looks like he's...
Yeah, I see him.
You see a guy, look, is he descending for the building also?
He's descending really quick, too, yeah.
Well, that's...
2,500 feet now. He just dropped 800 feet in like one sweep.
That's another situation. What kind of airplane is that? Can you guys tell?
I don't know. I'll read it out in a minute. Another one just hit the building.
Wow.
Oh my God. Another one just hit it hard.
Another one just hit the World Trade.
The whole building just came apart.
Oh, holy smokes. All right, I guess you guys can be busy.
All right, Tom Rankin, there it is, documentary evidence of that moment. It was an event. It was a real thing that happened in time and space.
Yeah, that is an amazing document, as you say. That's sort of the pure fact. I mean, we hear it and we feel the emotion of it, but that is that moment that we've now come from in so many ways, 10 years of ways. It's also, the moment without any of the personality of the people that are there, without the human story of who's on the plane and who's in the building. But it's that key kind of linchpin that starts it all. That's an amazing piece of audio.
It is, because it reflects the moment before and after, the innocence in their voices, even in the immediate aftermath. There is no 9/11. There's no such thing as 9/11.
Yeah.
And they're calling it. They're calling it live. But it's hard to imagine that kind of innocence in their voice. Can you imagine seeing this event the way they saw it then?
Well, and what's also so wonderful about that kind of audio is I have an image of them. It's probably not the image that a photograph would have, but you get this image of that innocence and of that, he says, holy smoke, which, is both real and authentic reaction and now seems trivial, mm-hmm. knowing what we know now, but it's so real.
Tim, what's your sense of that? Again, trying to imagine yourself seeing that event with those eyes again. It's impossible for us to do, isn't it, given the amount of imagery and the way it's been narrated to us for 10 years?
Well, I think in some ways my response to the audio was that it's a kind of a contained image of the moment. It doesn't have contained within it a real understanding of the moments that preceded it, nor the moments that are to come. So it's a kind of it's a historical snapshot, and yet it is not historical in the sense that it doesn't connect to what came before and what comes after. It's not in the flow. It's just this snapshot. And I think that's not an uncommon – we have that – even though that's new in a fascinating clip – we have those kind of images in our mind. Where were you when 9/11 happened? And there's we have a kind of a snapshot and
fragment.
Contained and fragmentary.
Mm-hmm. But just in terms of our understanding since, because we've seen now so many images have become iconic. They have been become the story of 9/11 for us. It's hard for us to really connect with that event that day. Or do you feel that? I mean, I certainly do. I can't connect with that event anymore.
No, because
I connect with the memory of it.
Right. We see all the images. I mean, I've said the last week in discussing this with different people, you can close your eyes and get a kind of slideshow of images that you're not sure where you got them. And you're seeing what you've already seen, and are you really seeing anything new? Are you seeing anything real, quote unquote? Are you seeing what you were told other people saw? How do you get a fresh view? It reminds me of Walker Percy's notion of a sovereign vision. How do you get this idea in a new way? Because we're 10 years since, and so you would think that all these fragments would lead to another level of understanding, and the visions would be refreshed and expanded and deepened.
Well,
and that's our challenge.
I mean, that's the question. Do all of these images and all of these narratives help us, or are they distractions? Are they confuses?
Well, I mean, I think we have to answer that individually. My feeling is that when there's too many of them, there's enormous distraction, and we can't see anything. I mean, it's a trite notion, but we can be so inundated we see nothing. And so the idea of focusing on a handful of things or personalizing it, hearing a voice of somebody and really understanding one life may be the only way we can understand this major historical moment.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is having changed in some ways since 9/11 is the expansion of security and documentation is such that if we don't have film footage – we think it didn't happen. I was actually talking to a public official about a North Carolina public official about a really nasty exchange that he had with some Latino kids. And his bottom line position was, put it on YouTube. In other words, did you or did you not? How do you feel about this? Why did you do that?
If it's
he
not
put it on YouTube.
YouTube
he would not
happen.
Say he did not because he knew that he did.
Yeah.
But it had to be put on YouTube or it didn't exist. And yet, with all the you know fusillade of images, we're sometimes it's harder and harder to put them to make sense of them and put them some of that kind of, in a kind of coherent narrative so that we have our own understanding of what we think we lived through.
Well, that's because and the way digital media works is that this is a personal experience. It's also a collective experience, but the collective now is much more personal. We do get it on our PC via YouTube. So is there a collective understanding of this?
Well, it's very hard to get. I mean, it's very hard to ferret out for ourselves that collective understanding and to even get an individual understanding because we are so inundated. If it happened now, we'd have even more images. We'd have all our cell phone images. And would that get us any more to the truth of this moment? Let's just say a moment of good and evil, a moment of terrible, kind of irredeemable loss. Would it give us more facts that would lead to more understanding? I don't think so. I mean, it might be, as a photographer, I can't have enough pictures in one sense, but I also know that to get to the emotional truth, you don't get to the emotional truth by having a larger stack of documentary facts.
So what are you doing at the center, for instance, Center for Documentary Studies?
Well, we have an installation that Laura Poitras did called Oh Say Can You See? And it's she went out after, right after, she's a filmmaker and has made some major narrative documentaries. But right after 9/11, she filmed the faces of people grieving and looking at Ground Zero. You never see Ground Zero. And she used audio from the national anthem at the World Series at the Yankees. And it's an installation, and it calls into question lots of our assumptions. And you never see or hear what we just heard. You don't see the fact of the buildings being hit, but you see people's response. And it's very meditative and reflective and reverent. We're also playing audio from Looking Across America, narratives of people talking about the impact of 9/11. That were collected right after by the Library of Congress.
You know, Tim, we're trying to talking about getting at some kind of essential understanding of this, but has that ever been true? I mean, take a look at we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, and we see how differently it was understood in the immediate aftermath, 50 years, 100 years, and now 150 years later, as new documents come through and new voices get added to the narrative.
Well, absolutely. It's always been, history's always been impossible. You know, the past is gone. You cannot conjure it back through some act of magic, no matter how good a writer or documentarian you might be. And yet you're trying, without an understanding of what we've been through and who we are as a result, then we're lost. And yet to put that together has always been near impossible, but you still have to try, or you're just floating in space. If you don't remember who you are and where you came from, and what experience has shaped you, and what you have learned from that, and what does that tell you about where we're going forward, then you truly are lost. And sometimes I think we are lost in a sea of images and information. We've got lots more information, and yet perhaps even less truth.
Yeah, it seems to me new understanding shouldn't bother us. They need to be understood in your current context to help you move forward from where you are today. So to recontextualize and re-understand something is not necessarily some kind of burden or mistake, mm-hmm. right?
Also, the language of imagery is peculiar to its form. When you look at if you read the text of the evening news, it's only a short column of print. Its information is slight, but you're shown pictures, and it's really like Orwell's, like Huxley's The Feelies, because the language of pictures is a language of emotion, not, you know, so when you're reading a paragraph, you can settle on it and chew on it and think about it, but the film, you know, it talks in feeling.
We're going to take a break right here talking about 9/11 and how we remember. When we come back, we'll look at how some Muslim Americans approach the anniversary. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about 9/11, 10 years later. Is it possible to cut through a decade of accumulated symbols, meanings, and politics to mark this anniversary in a constructive way? And how do we commemorate the event collectively when Americans' experience of the event in recent years since have been so different? With me are Tom Rankin, director of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke, and Duke scholar Tim Tyson, author of the acclaimed bestseller Blood Don't Sign My Name. Joining us in the studio is Samia Seregedin, an Egyptian-born novelist who has long made her home in the Triangle. She is the author of The Cairo House and The Naqib's Daughter. Samia, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're talking about remembering 9/11, how we do this collectively. And for people in this country, Muslim Americans, it is a freighted experience. And you've talked about your experience that day in Chapel Hill.
Absolutely. And it was a dual experience. I experienced it first as an American mother and then as a Muslim other. And for the first 3 hours, I didn't know if my son was in the World Trade Center building number 5, because he worked for one of the banks there, on any given Tuesday. He could have been in London or he could have been in New York. And I didn't know for about 3 hours.
Oh,
and yes, and then until he called me 3 hours later and just said, "Mom, I'm okay, but I have to get off." And then I thought of all the mothers who didn't get that phone call. And my next thought was to pray that no one from the Middle East had any connection to this. And when that prayer wasn't answered, that's when I realized that after 20 years of believing that I and my family were completely integrated in American society, I had instantly lost the right to share in our national tragedy, and I'd lost the right to privacy, in a sense, not to be considered or seen as a representative of a community of sorts. So it was both at once that I experienced, and it was very dislocating. And then I can say also probably then as a writer, there was another way of experiencing this, which is it silences you. I think that was true for anyone who tries to express what they experienced that day, whether in art or in music or in words. It silences you because nothing ever seems relevant again. All the ordinary joys and passions and love and hate and ambition just suddenly become so irrelevant. You feel there's nothing you can write about that would be relevant, except 9/11, and that is too huge. And it's too huge to fit into the parameters of our experience, the framework of our lives. It just won't fit. And so you're silenced until the day comes when the event shrinks just enough in immediacy that it can fit into a parameter or a framework, and your mind can grapple with it. And then we each express it in different ways. If you're a writer in words, if you're an artist in that medium, if you're a musician in that. But the initial reaction is to be silenced.
How long did it take for that feeling to wear off?
Years. For me, it took years. I think it was 3 or 4 years before I could publish anything, but it wasn't about 9/11. That took even longer. And when I finally was able to write about 4 short stories that directly addressed the event, that wasn't until 2008, perhaps. Or let's put it this way, I might have written them right away, but not been able to bring myself to share them or publish them till many years later, because it was too raw. And I just realized I didn't have any perspective. And I was listening earlier to Tom and Tim and you, Frank, and what you were all saying about that loss of innocence and the way our vision has adjusted, and we can now fit that into our parameters and our thinking and our model of life, whereas at the beginning, it was just too overwhelming. It didn't fit anything.
But a model for you that is complicated by that double consciousness of being a Muslim American and a writer, trying to put into context the unimaginable.
That's true. That's true. And it's particularly difficult because, especially if you were the type of person who was very well integrated and didn't really consider religion anything but one's own personal business, and was seen that way by everyone that you dealt with, whether it was at work or in your own neighborhood, where your neighbors, after 8 years, still didn't imagine that you could possibly be a Muslim, for instance, or at least the vision of a Muslim that they got after 9/11. And that forces you to do one of two things, either to sort of keep a low profile and go underground, or on the contrary, to assume an identity that may not really be totally comfortable for you, but that was necessary at the time to try to counter a whole range of funhouse images of the other and of Muslims and of Islam, and to try to disassociate the religion from the atrocities committed by a few people falsely in the name of that religion. Yeah. That was very difficult to do, but necessary.
On the State of Things today, talking about memorializing 9/11, Samia Saregedin, a writer, is with us, along with Tom Rankin from the Center for Documentary Studies and Duke scholar Tim Tyson. And joining us now on the phone is Abdullah Antepli, Duke University's Muslim chaplain. Abdullah, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're talking today about memory and how we reconnect with this event. And, of course, as we were saying, for Muslim Americans, the anniversary holds more layers of complexity. Tell us how you experienced this event at the time and then in the aftermath and 10 years since.
It has been, as you said, a very rough and rocky journey for American Muslims, where they completely caught unprepared to this hurricane and the post 9/11 hurricanes, and still they are not entirely in control of the conversation about their faith, about their faith tradition, and then, as beautifully mentioned by the by the colleague and the writer, they still do not necessarily know how to bring the both American and Muslim identities together. But I think for all Americans, not only Muslim ones, this 10th anniversary should be a season of reflection. Not only we should honor and remember the victims, but also we should also look at the mirror as Americans as a whole. What have we become? And how have we changed in response to 9/11? Did we reveal the best of ourselves in reaction, in response to 9/11 and this barbaric, tragic terrorist attacks? And I think whether or not the evil forces behind 9/11, their success will be based on our ability to respond to these questions in one way or another.
Well, Tim Tyson, as you hear what Abdullah and Telpley suggest, that this is a time to reflect and to reflect on ourselves as a nation, that seems to be the conversation that has been out of bounds for all of us. Is it?
Well, it doesn't have to be. We have to, I think it's very important that we think about who we have become as a result of this. And I think Dr. Antepli makes a beautiful point, important point, in saying that the outcome of 9/11 is really still up. You know, it's the jury's still out on what the meaning is, because what have we become and what are we going to become? Are we content with what we've become? Have we examined that? So I think the ultimate meaning of these events are still. Somebody asked, I think it was, Mao Zedong was asked about what he thought about the French Revolution. And he said, I think the jury's still out on that. Well, of course, It was 200 years later. But
have we lost the vocabulary? You know, Tom Rankin, Samia Seregin talks about not being able to participate in the national tragedy as a Muslim American. It seems to me that progressives in some ways have been somewhat muted or struggling to find a voice and a vocabulary and a symbolism that reflects their outrage, their sadness, and their sense of recovery, how we can recover ourselves.
I think what was so powerful about what Samia said in talking about being silenced, she told one of the most powerful stories I've heard in this anniversary about her experience. And so even though she felt silenced at the time, there is no silence in that story we just heard, and anybody can go listen to it over and over again and reflect just around that. And when we talk about the abundance and kind of overwhelming images and what are we going to look at, and we see the new People magazine where you can learn about 9/11 children but also find out, you know, who's pregnant on the reality shows, it's hard to get any reflection, get to a reflective moment. But that pearl of a story she just told, which, I mean, you couldn't get more powerful of a way of remaking and reclaiming that moment that may have come out of silence, but it's not been muted at all. And I think that's our opportunity in these anniversaries.
It seems to me the beauty of that pearl, too, is that it's an individual narrative, and yet within it there's this larger truth. And sometimes I think that it's so hard. We were talking about the difficulty of sort of marshaling all these images and facts, and yet within a human being's truth, we can see something much larger. And I also think that the double consciousness that you speak of is something that African Americans have known. Of course, W.E.B. Du Bois talks about that, but also Southerners who know what it is like. African Americans and Southerners know what it's like to have this kind of horror of the past and this national narrative that they are caught up in and cannot participate in and or control.
Well, I guess it gets to, you know, the whole controversy over the Silent Sam statue on the Carolina campus, erected in 1913 in honor of those students who left to fight for the Confederacy.
Right. Yes, and if you ask a question of that monument, just to try to determine what does the history mean, if you actually look at examine the history, then there's outrage that somehow you violated the sacred statue by asking anything. You know, which is, of course, what history is about, is looking at what did this mean.
And what a monument should provoke is conversation and question and dialogue and reflection.
If you want to talk about the violation, try to build a mosque next to that monument.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Then we will know.
Precisely.
Abdullah, for you, has the conversation gotten any easier? Is it easier for you to feel like you may participate, that this is your memorial and commemoration as an American too?
My honest and candid answer is not yet. I think it's very painful as a result of this eventful 10 years. In the minds and hearts of many Americans, American Muslims do not have enough moral legitimacy, neither to love this country, nor to grieve about the pains and the sufferings of these people, nor to criticize this country when they see this country is making mistakes and making some unethical and immoral choices. That doesn't necessarily help. It has very unwelcoming, disempowering power over American Muslims, that as if 9/11 is purely a non-Muslim story, as if Muslims were not involved, as if Muslims were not part of the whole 9/11 story, unfortunately.
And Samia, you know, the last time you were here, you talked about the importance. We were talking about the uprisings in Egypt, and you talked about how important it was that young Egyptians were just now discovering their real history.
Well, that's true. That's true, because Tom Friedman, who very often has insight, but in this case, he was really off base. He was saying that the Arab Spring was inspired by the U.S., by China, by Israel. Well, to some extent, I'm sure, but really, it had a lot more to do with young Egyptians looking back to their own, and I'm sure Tunisians as well, looking back to their own history, which in Egypt was far more secular, democratic, before the 1952 coup that did away with the monarchy, but it also did away with the multi-party system, and a very active, although of course incomplete and but nascent democratic multi-party system. And in the past few years, there's been a whole re-examination of Egyptian history in books, in film, in television, and we were talking right now about the importance of all of these of documentaries, of art, of all of these methods and forms of re-examining, revisiting, reformulating history. And in the case of 9/11, of course, it's far more recent history. But in the case of Egypt, it was the history of before 1952, which entire generations of young Egyptians were totally unfamiliar with, completely. They had no idea that their country had parties, that their country had elections, and that it was not invariably the rule that one had to live under an autocratic single-party regime. So this was a great inspiration for them to reach again, to regain those lost rights and freedoms. But if I may just add one thing, that it may look like it's a little bit of an indirect link, but I hope not, between the Arab Spring and 9/11, and that is this, that the image of Arabs, of Muslims, has deteriorated so alarmingly and painfully in the West, but particularly in the U.S. over the past 10 years, understandably because of 9/11, but alarmingly, so that anti-Islamic rhetoric is avowable. It's the last avowable prejudice left in these United States. No one would dream of questioning the right of an African American or anyone of any religious minority being a judge or a congressman or a senator, or ask them to take loyalty oaths. But that seems to be entirely the rhetoric of so many presidential candidates, who must know that they're appealing, obviously, to their public. So if there is any chance at all to retreat from that kind of image, that kind of clash of civilizations, perhaps it is in the Arab Spring, because people will see young Arabs and overwhelmingly Muslim as well in a different image, as hopeful, aspiring to the same things that we all do: democracy and freedom.
Will they, Abdullah and Tepli, or have they been? Has this entire burst of freedom in the Arab and Muslim world been contextualized and framed by 9/11?
I think 9/11 has made a huge impact and has been a catalyst in seeking more democracy, more liberty and freedom, and establishment of the civic society in the Muslim world. There's no doubt about that. I think it sort of empowered in a really indirect and unique way the silent majority who have been suffering in the hands of their own dictators. But of course, it's one of the many, many different factors. But it was really an interesting and ironic picture when the whole world was sort of crying for more democracy and freedom, and how our society here in the United States, we in the last 10 years sort of conceded, and our commitment to those freedom, liberties, and the democracy and the civic society and secular democracy have consistently deteriorated at, in I don't want to be too melodramatic, but I think before and post 9/11, we have shied away from those foundational ideals that those Arab countries and the Muslim countries have been crying out and putting their life out there to achieve. That was a really contrasting and somewhat troubling picture.
Do you think, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but I wonder if 9/11 changes the way we, I mean, there's no way to know how we would have seen it otherwise, but if we don't see clearly what's going on in the Arab world now as a result of 9/11.
Certainly, I think that's...
I think if you follow the events in Egypt, Tunis, and other places through the American media, the post-9/11 monstrous, scary image of Islam as a religion and Muslims as people were sort of blurring the whole picture.
Yeah, I agree.
We were not able to see this accurate picture. We were coming up with somewhat really irrational comments. We were appearing because our hopes had overcome by our fears, and our fears were blending our rationale, our lenses, and it was enabling us to understand the situation accurately.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Abdullah Antepli, Duke's Muslim chaplain, Samia Saregedin, author of The Cairo House and The Naqib's Daughter, Tom Rankin, director of Duke's Center for Documentary Studies, and Tim Tyson, senior research scholar at the center and visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture at Duke Divinity School. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure.
Coming up next, composer J. Mark Scarce and his 9/11-inspired symphonic work. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about the 10th anniversary of 9/11, how we memorialize such a world-changing event both individually and as a society, and what opportunities this anniversary provides for reflection, catharsis, and a deeper understanding. In the studio now is a man whose response to 9/11 has been artistic. Composer J. Mark Scarce is director of the music department at NC State. His piece, The Thread, is a setting of Toni Morrison's poem, The Dead of September 11th. You can hear performances tonight through this weekend by the North Carolina Symphony, and we will hear some of that at the end of the program today. Mark Scarce, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Great. It's...
Well, I'm happy to have you, and I want to ask you how this piece came about.
Well, this was written by Toni Morrison 2 days after 9/11, which is hard to imagine that someone could create something so wonderful and level-headed at the same time. And it was published in November, and I read it at that time and started to hear music. So I wrote away to Toni Morrison for rights and didn't hear for a couple of months and wrote again saying, I would really love to set this. And she called my office in Maine, where we were at the time, and said she'd like to hear some music, and I sent her some, and within a week she said, you know, the poem's yours, wow, which was a wonderful moment, and then all I had to face was the blank white page and not get in the way.
Well, what were the first notes? How did the music come to you at first?
Well, I realized when I was first witnessing her words wash over me that they were being sung to me, and I wasn't actually taking them in with my own voice. And I heard a low female voice, so I knew that it was a mezzo-soprano that was going to sing this. So I knew that much, and I heard an orchestra, so I knew it was a large canvas of some kind. And then, you know, I mean, the problem was I had these words in front of me, and I knew they were going to be sung, but I also wanted to remove myself. I didn't want to get in the way of these words, and I wanted to do what music can do so well, which is to give that moment of reflection that you all have been speaking about, and to give the moment of the day, which had all of the sorrow, but also all of the anger in it, and jihad in it,
And music can go multiple directions at the same time. So I knew I could do this and create a frame for this, for these wonderful words. So the first notes are actually a solo violin. And that didn't come to me for days and days and days because I couldn't find a way into the piece. And I realized if a solo violin steps forward and plays its notes, it will be like a Virgil to Dante. It will lead us through this particular hell.
What about that voice that you heard singing? Was that a discernible melody, a tune of some kind?
It was, and I realized that the first time we hear that voice, it should have no words because I remember where I was when I heard this news, and it wouldn't go into my head. I couldn't wrap my head around it. So when the voice first sings, it just sings ah, and it sings a lullaby, a minor third that we all know so well. That is in every culture on the face of the planet. Every culture has a minor third.
Interesting that Toni Morrison wanted to hear the music first before she was going to release it, did, and then said it's yours. Did you then work with her at all after that?
I did call her again when I had the solo violin idea because I wanted to be sure that I wasn't going to be in the way. And she said, you know, my grandfather played violin, right? And I said, I would love to say yes, but... It came to me out of the poem, and she says, it's because it's in the poem. It's with me every day. And, I think the reason I felt a violin is because it is in the poem. The intention is there. So that opening violin melody gets played over and over and recurs until finally at the end of the work, everybody is singing that melody in a great chorus of grief.
It's interesting that your artistic response to 9/11 really responds to a work of art, not the event itself. I mean, in a sense, it was that poem that got you going.
Exactly. And we've heard your other speakers say that at the time, it's almost too much, that I needed the filter of Toni Morrison to provide me a way in, and I think a way for many people into especially our remembrance of that day. As we've talked and heard, that it's hard for a person to draw up an experience of 10 years ago, but art can do that. Art can set aside the moment and emotionally pull you back in for that moment of reflection.
And look at what Toni Morrison exhorts us to do. The poem is written to the dead of September 11th. I want to read just a little section of it after she addresses the dead and talks about the daunting task before her. In the poem, it reads, But I would not say a word until I could set aside all I know or believe about nations, wars, leaders, the governed and ungovernable, all I suspect about armor and entrails. First, I would freshen my tongue, abandon sentences crafted to no evil, wanton or studied, explosive or quietly sinister, whether born of a sated appetite or hunger, of vengeance or simple compulsion to stand before falling down. I would purge my language of hyperbole, trying to get back to that time of innocence, to experience this thing as it was, not how it's been narrated.
Absolutely. And even the narration of minutes afterwards, as we all remember, there's another line further on, I must not claim false intimacy or summon an overheated heart glazed just in time for a camera. There were a lot of overheated hearts that day.
Now, you did this in the year after. It has been performed since.
It has. It's had quite a life. I'm happy to say I think everyone who wishes a work of art would have a life beyond a particular event. And I didn't choose the title of her poem as the title for my work. I took the title of my work from a line late in her poem, this thread thrown between your humanity and mine. So this thread is what it's all about. And under that title. It's been programmed in a variety of ways, with Shostakovich to talk about the individual. It's with Mozart. It's wedged between two Mozarts this weekend. So I tell my class I'm the meat in a Mozart sandwich this weekend. Just the context really provides one avenue into the work. But the work itself, I think, speaks to us because I'm alive and I was alive then. And I'm responding just as the poet was, and I think the musicians all respond to it, and I think audiences have and will as well.
What were your hopes for the piece in putting it together?
Again, I know this sounds odd. I didn't want to be in the way. I really wanted Toni Morrison's words to come through, and I wanted to write the work in such a way that you could remove her words and still know what the intention of every word in the poem was, you know, without those words being there. So one way I did that was to not just include the solo violin to help us bring in, but there are random acts of violence in the work, which are just on a single note. And that always takes the most rehearsal time to explain how to convey violence on a single note. But I think that's what it's all about. Violence isn't a large thing. It's a small thing that just explodes out of one moment. There's light that refracts off the sun on the side of the World Trade Center. For those of us who remember it, there were times you couldn't even look at it because it was so bright. That's in the orchestra. And then there's four sets of five bells, which is the sign of the fallen firefighter. And I think as many of us remember that when they took out the last steel beam from the World Trade Center, they had bagpipes and a 5555 code, four sets of five rings of the bells, which I put in the orchestra. They're all on a particular pitch. It's a B natural. And so the whole work ends on the same pitch that one would hear if one heard those bells in New York.
And silence is built into the piece. So we hear the bells and then there is silence as part of the piece.
You have that, a reflective space in which to take it all in.
You talked about the violence coming at these odd points and sounding dissonant, but it's also the context that is the magnitude and shock of violence.
That's
and so
right.
Placing it in a musical context gives us that sense of how awful this was.
Absolutely. And it comes out of nowhere and it destroys everything that you have created in front of you.
So this thing has had a life of its own. It is now 9 years old. How do you hear this now, and how is that different, or is it, from what you were feeling when you put it together?
That's a great question. I mean, first I should say, you know, we should all be grateful for the North Carolina Symphony that it's here to provide us these reflective moments. And, you know, no two orchestras are the same. No two singers are the same. And what we have here is really a picture I had painted on a large canvas, but transferred to a canvas three times as big. The North Carolina Symphony will perform it with three times the number of strings I had in mind, which gives us a sea in which to swim, really. The tempos are slower than I had noted them in the score, but it's an interpretation. It has a real conviction and a real solemnness to it. And I'm deeply honored to be with Mozart, the grand master who every young composer has to find a way around. But juxtaposed here, it will be a very emotional moment because of the larger canvas and because of Mozart.
Give us a sense of what the audience will hear and experience then.
There will be Mozart's Ave Verum, which is 46 measures only, hard to imagine, 46 measures of the most exquisite music on earth. Then my solo violin will step forward and play this small fragment of a melody. The mezzo will sing her lullaby, and before we know it, you're wrapped in the arms of this singer who is holding you. The music then goes through about 20 minutes of relaying Toni Morrison's text until, as I say, in the end, we're just all in this sea of grief that then has a quiet moment, which I think we'll hear at the end of the show, where the tension is like a fist. If you put a fist down on the keyboard and played all those notes, that's what you hear, the tension of a fist that slowly opens.
Mark, thank you so much for being on the program today.
I thank you for having me.
Composer J. Mark Scarce is director of the music department at NC State. His 9/11-inspired work, This Thread, will be heard tonight through Saturday in performance by the North Carolina Symphony. Mark will also give pre-concert lecture and participate in post-concert question and answer sessions at tonight's and Saturday's performance at the May Mandy Concert Hall. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix, Alex Granados, Isaac Davey Aronson. Jenny Mueller is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director, managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. You're listening to North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. We're going to end our program today reflecting artistically on the music that is reflected this day and this commemoration. A few minutes of This Thread by composer J. Mark Scarce.